If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Kate Kretz is an acclaimed multidisciplinary artist known for her intricate, time-intensive works that challenge political and societal issues. Her art spans various mediums, mainly focusing on embroidery and soft sculpture, but they always reflect on cultural and political themes. Kate's work has been showcased internationally and she continues to influence and provoke through her art and her writing. This is the second part of our needle exchange, and this time Kate and I discuss the challenge of the presidential choices in 2024 and the importance of recognising and addressing those challenges. She shares how her book, Art From Your Core, serves as a guide for artists and can empower individuals to find their voice and make a difference, and how the book was an evolution of the work that she started with art classes and workshops. She emphasises the need for art education to focus on developing artist voices and advocates for artists to prioritise their voice more than prioritising making a living, because the first part will amplify the second part. Kate also reveals her favourite book, the kind of music that she likes, and a really interesting fact about the things that she collects, which, yeah, I've never heard of anybody collect the things that Kate collects, but I think it's a great idea. Kate is someone to be reckoned with, and it was a lovely having a chat with her. So I hope you enjoyed this second part of the conversation. Do listen to the first part, episode 41, if you haven't heard that already. And if you did enjoy the show, if you're able to leave a review on your favourite podcasting platform, why, that would be marvellous. I'll be back next week with another conversation with another needlework artist. So until then, enjoy the show. I want to ask a question from the standpoint of someone based in the UK who is not particularly, let's say, I don't know. I understand politics over here, don't fully understand politics over there. And I don't want this to become a long political discourse. But seeing as how you're here, seeing as how it's a topic that I know you're familiar with, how can it be that a man that used to be the president, who is facing loads of criminal charges, can get to nearly be the president again? How is it that you can be a criminal?
I can't, you know, the people who support him talk about him living rent free in our heads. And that is the truth, because the amount of worry that he causes in so many of our citizens, and the disbelief, really, the disbelief. And so my work is, I tried to make it, because there were so many lies being thrown around. I think somebody counted and said 30,000 while he was president. I wanted to create concrete manifestations of the truth. It was for my sanity as well as people that I know, because there's just, you know, it's been a long, long time that people get together and they just say, you know, oh my God, I can't fathom what is happening. And you know, I think in a way the work I make is a way to just feel like I'm making something to fight against it. You know, I go to protests, you know, I do all kinds of things, but I don't know. It's kind of calling out the truth amidst not just lies, but massive gaslighting, because there's parts of the media that, you know, perpetuate his agenda. And, you know, I'm terrified. We renewed my daughter's passport this year.
Right.
I mean, we're ready. And, you know, I did a lot of research on, you know, how Hitler came to power. And I'm not going to get into it, but, you know, it's fascinating to watch history repeating itself and the obliviousness that accompanies it. So, you know, we may be packing our bags. I don't know. And you know, people keep telling me, I keep telling them what my next piece is going to be, which I hope is sort of a capstone for my MAGA hat pieces. And people say, it's an election year. You shouldn't be making that, you know. Take all the bumper stickers off your car. You know, they say that, you know, they might go after artists or journalists or whatever. And it's hard to fathom that reality. But, you know, he's probably one of the most vindictive people on the planet. So,
it's just quite, I want to at some point have a needle exchange with Diana Waymar, who did the Tiny Pricks project.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
I want to say to her, I bet you thought you'd finished. Because <that's, laughs> I think that's the thing that gets me, is you thought, like with your work, you thought, okay, well, now it comes to an end. But it doesn't seem to be coming to an end. That's the bewildering thing.
Yeah, I'm working on like a monumental piece compared to all the others. And it's, you know, I'm kind of shifting a little bit towards the followers, because, you know, one crazy person can, you know, just be walking down the street muttering to themselves, but it's all the other enablers, both political and, you know, citizens who are allowing this to happen. And so that's kind of where I'm going next. And I pray that this is the last one. I really pray that it is.
But let's talk about some of the early works though, because I think there's a sort of an iterative process, I guess, where you did some work and then you started doing the MAGA hats, and then you did the flag. And I mean, can you just tell us about some of those projects?
Let's see. Well, I think when he was first in office, for the first year and a half, I was doing drawings. And they were just of his disembodied mouth captured mid-lie floating on a black background. So they were prismacolors. They were really kind of lurid colors. And then I was doing a lot of research, and I said, I need to address this branding that he's done with this hat. And virtually all presidents almost have said, let's make America great again. But he's the one who turned it into a brand. And to be perfectly frank, like I said, I've done a lot of research, and I think that his having all these seasons of being on television was what got him elected and what got him these followers who think that they know him, and also became inured to seeing him as a leader or a boss figure. You know, I don't know what, I don't watch TV. So it was like 13, 14 seasons. But so I started to, frustrated with the lies, I started to buy counterfeit MAGA hats, because I didn't want to put money in his pockets. And I ripped them apart, which was cathartic in and of itself. One day I went down and ripped them in front of the White House, and there were three layers of fence between the Trump White House and me. And then I started to reconfigure them into shapes that I thought told the real truth about the racism behind this man and the sexism and how he was affecting our culture. And so I did a handmaid's bonnet out of white MAGA hats, and I did a KKK hood. The KKK hood was the first one. I did a Nazi armband where the swastika is from a black hat. So the letters are actually following along with the swastika, Make America Great Again. And then I took one hat and ripped it to shreds. There was nothing left of it. It was just a pile of threads. And it was all very cathartic, but it was, you know, full of rage, as you said, for me. And then I started to think about, what is a positive way that I could look at this? And how could I flip it, you know? And so I got a very large flag. I think it's, 4 by 6 feet. I don't know meters, but and I started to rip out all the machine sewn white stars, and then I replaced them with hand sewn stars in the colors of the melanin scale that represents all America, which is supposed to be a melting pot, right? And so it took me 550 hours to make that piece.
Right.
Machine sewing, where they're sewing from the front and the back at the same time, is like excruciating to pull out, especially if you don't want to rip the fabric underneath. And so, and the title is very important to that piece. And now I'm going to try to remember it. It's reparation.
Where our greatness lies.
Thank you so much. I knew it was more poetic than that. but anyway, and I really thought about the white stars as being, even though that's not what the stars symbolize, I really thought about the white stars as, you know, supposedly representing the 50 states, but then they were all white. And I thought of them as representing white supremacism. And so that's why I was ripping them out. And that's why I was replacing them with skin tones that reflect our population much more. And it's a really important piece for me, but I finished it kind of at the tail end of the pandemic, and I finished it, when I was starting my book. And so I haven't had a lot of time to promote it, but it's a piece that rolls up. And so my vision for the piece is to have it, 'cause it travels super easy, is to have it just travel around in a tube. And most museums have one wall someplace where they put stuff. And I just wanted people to see themselves represented in the flag. You know, if you saw any footage of January 6th, the coup against our government, that all these patriots were wielding this flag and they were beating people with it. And the meaning has changed. So, you know, if you live in the US and you're driving down the road and you see somebody with a flag sticker on their big truck, you're kind of like, oh, okay. And you step back a little bit, you know? And that's not right that it's come to, I'm not advocating for that we change our flag, but I just felt like I wanted to do something. And I suppose, you know, since I was raised Catholic, it might be a penance of sorts, since it was a 550-hour project.
Because there's a sort of trade-off. Like, we have a sort of similar thing over here. I think sometimes the Union Jack is used in situations that don't have a very good vibe. And I think that it's that trade-off, because being patriotic about your country is one thing, but when the story of your country changes, it's quite hard to perhaps maintain the same sense of pride, or, you know, mm-hmm. like, you know, I've had conversation, with Dr. Isabella Rossner, who's curator at the Royal School of Needlework. And she was talking, mm-hmm. you know, we were talking about the people who used to be in Los Angeles, but like 400 years ago, you know, all of those kind mm-hmm. of stories and what the patriotism of that version of America is in relation to what we have now. And yeah, it's mm-hmm. funny, isn't it? It's quite hard to negotiate a path through that that can say, I'm proud of America, but not the America that is being yes. pushed out on the media channels. Trying to find that nuance. Right. You've identified, or you've, it seems as though this work has unwittingly plugged into a broader theme of bully culture, which is something that you've talked about as well. Is that something you expected, or have you just looked back and gone, oh?
Well, you know, bully culture started as a series of work that I thought would be like any other series of work. But I guess when you've been researching it for over a decade and making the stuff for 8 years, it's kind of become my work. But, you know, I think the bully culture work started when, you know, around the time my daughter was born or right after she was born. And I don't know, you know, I'm a bit removed from popular culture. I'm not a total Luddite, but, you know, I don't follow pop culture very, very much. So it was that I started to look around me and I started to see television shows and, you know, just, you know, things on t-shirts and things like that, that I realized showed a kind of aggressiveness and competitiveness, which I can't get into it too much. I'm hoping to write a book about it, but, you know, people say kind of justify bad behavior by citing Darwin and survival of the fittest. But, you know, the fact is that we've evolved more because of cooperation than we have competition, that we can come together and, you know, build things and, you know, do things. And so I, you know, I took a hard look, and because I'm not steeped in it, I have sort of an alien view of a lot of what I see around me. And so, you know, I started to see, well, you know, there's moms who don't want their kids to be bullied on the playground, but they're watching, I don't know if you know this, Housewives of, there's a series called Housewives of, and they're fighting each other. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know? And, you know, to a certain extent, sports culture is a part of this and how we divide ourselves up into tribes and we're, you know, let's beat the hell out of them and whatever. But so I started making this work, and you know, it really took me over, and I started making things that I could never have imagined I would make. And this really helped me with my book, because I'd always sort of listened to the universe a little bit before, but this was just like, you know, I was making so many pieces. I was so prolific for years and years. And some of the stuff that I made scared me. You know, the way I describe it is I would invite friends over for a studio visit, and it wasn't to have a cup of tea and say, oh, this is nice. It was like for us to look at it and say, what is this and where did it come from and what do you think, you know, because it really was like a meteor that crashed into my studio. And then we're standing there looking at it and we're like, oh my gosh, this is really intense. And I started surveying my Facebook friends and saying, have you ever seen art that's too intense? And, you know, the answer is for a lot of people, yes, you know, not really among my artist friends, but people who might see the work. It was addressing a lot of difficult subjects, and I did research on the subjects, and I had like, you know, dog fighting and things like that, because they're all like a part of it. And just like rape culture, there are degrees of it, you know. A joke about a woman, you know, nobody's going to come up and police you, but it's a slippery slope into more violent behavior, and it's a slippery slope into being a bystander because, you know, that's not about me. And
it's like boiling a frog, isn't it?
Yes. I love that analogy. So I was making the bully culture work, and then, you know, we had our 2016 election, Clinton versus Trump, and I, you know, I'm a pretty hardcore feminist, but I kept saying to people, our country is too misogynistic to elect a woman president. And my, you know, my feminist friends were really angry at me. And I'm like, I don't think that's true, but I see this. I've been studying this for years and years, and this is the way it is. So I was, you know, people got really mad at me, but I kind of saw it. And then it happened and people were shocked. And then I started thinking, oh my God, you know, this is the manifestation of what I've been making work about for, at that point, 6 or 7 years. So I just sort of folded it in and, you know, it'll probably be my work for the rest of my life. I have no way of knowing that.
What's incredible, there's two incredible things. One is, it's incredible that in a country of however many people live in America, that the presidential choices in 2024 are the 82-year-old you've already got, or the orange guy you've had before who's known. Like, it's incredible that that's your choice. And I think a lot of people outside of that are just baffled by the system. But drawing a line, what's interesting to me then is a lot of this work, like you say, you're making work, it scares you. You're making work that is looking at the world around you and just recognizing the challenges that you face. And then you write a book that is almost like a kind of Excalibur. It's almost like you're giving people a sword with which maybe they can cleave their way through this madness.
I love that. Wow. I have to think about that. I really love that idea. But it is. I mean, because I talk about using work to shape our world. And so I guess I was sort of pushed to make the work or the book in a certain way because we got all these gathering storm clouds, you know, and if you want to be an entrepreneur and sell happy stuff, that's great. I have it all over my walls. I don't live with the work that I make. I've made work for museums since I started making work. I've never, you know, I live with some of the easier pieces that I've made, but you know, I surround myself with pretty happy stuff. But it is in a way a reminder that, God, you know, the pandemic and fascism rising all over the world. Wake up, everybody. You know, we are people that can do something about this.
Mm. Did the book, so you said the book was somewhat inspired by your professional career, the things you teach people. Was the book always going to come out, or was it like, you know, 5-6 years ago, someone said, do you want to write a book? And it went like that.
It's God, you know, it started, I'm trying to think what year it might have been. I was teaching at Florida International University in Miami from 1995 to 2005. And we used to have this spring review or something where all the art majors had 15 minutes in front of the full faculty. And there were always some students that were lost. They didn't know what to make art about. And we had never told them how to figure out what to make art about. And then there were people that, you know, we would kind of talk amongst ourselves in a kind way and say, what are we going to do about so-and-so, right? So we're having beer afterwards in the pub. And I'm like, I want to start a boot camp. And so the people who are lost are the people who keep, you know, making work that is sort of cliche or whatever, you know, write them a script and they'll come to me for a weekend and I'll like do a boot camp, which is, which is again, kind of like therapy. It's sort of stripping away bad stuff and then building you into what, you know, you might want to be. So, that's how it started. And that was a long time ago, 20 years ago. So then I started to come up with exercises almost immediately. And I started to incorporate it into my classes that I taught at FIU because I was the BFA director. I was the last person to see everyone before they graduated. And I was helping them put up their senior shows and such. So I started to incorporate it into that. And then I moved up north and I was teaching a drawing practicum course, which was very much about finding your voice in drawing, in the drawing medium. Although a lot of people left doing needlework. But yeah, so then I incorporated, and then I was really seeing that this was working. And I started to offer workshops when I was a visiting artist. And I just got a lot of good feedback, and it, you know, occurred to me that I should make it into a book. And I think that idea first occurred to me maybe 8 years ago. But all along I've been, because I was teaching classes and doing the workshops, I've been collecting all of this information and I've been reading artist biographies. And so it was kind of natural that it become a book. The more I started to think about how higher art education is developing, the more I thought this needs to be a class that's taught in every art school, because a lot of artists are now interdisciplinary. And so, you know, what stays constant? Their voice. Mm. So if they're going to sculpt and they're going to paint and they're going to, you know, let this not be something that's sort of off on the side. It normally happens when you have a critique in whatever class and somebody says, oh, this isn't working, or go look at this artist, or, you know, and I just think it needs to be a foundation. It needs to be part of, you know, building yourself as an artist. And so the book evolved too. It started as a manifestation of the class. And then I started to think about, you know, I'm old and I have very little to lose. And so I've taken a lot of chances in the book. I've told, like I do with everything that I do, I've told a lot of truths and I've exposed some cognitive dissonance inherent in the life of an artist. And that I, at a certain point, because of the whole, like, how to make a living and versus voice, I just decided I'm going to be an advocate for people's voices. I'm going to address the making a living part because it would, you know, you can't not, but I can't do a lot of, you know, make a lot of qualifying remarks here and there and everywhere saying, you know, of course, you know, if you want to do this. I just said at the beginning, I am an advocate for your voice. And I'm going to say a lot of things about our culture, even about art education, that some people aren't going to like, but I really believe this. And I feel like it's backed up with many years of teaching. And I decided I'm going to make the book that I wish somebody had handed me at the beginning of my career. So that's sort of how it ended up. And, you know, people that have read it have said it's kind of like having a beer with your professor and everything's off the record. You know what I mean?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, like I say, what I need to do is I need to get a good physical copy of it and then I can have it as a bedtime read. But to me, it's up there. It's such a good book. And I think the thing is like you say, it's kind of non-medium specific, and I think that makes it all the better because, like, it also reminds me a bit of the War of Art, Stephen Pressfield, yes, one of those.
I love that book.
But yeah. Also, I don't know whether you, have you read The Creative Act by Rick Rubin?
It's on my to-read list. It's literally sitting next to my bed now. Yeah. And I know who this person is, you know, because of other contacts, but yeah.
Because of your massive hip-hop career. I got the audio version of that, which he's reading. And again, it's another one of those. I think sometimes what's great about these books and yours is that you don't have to be an artist to get the takeaway from it, but it might just encourage you to pay a bit more attention and to put a bit more beauty into the things you do anyway. So although you can pursue an artistic career, as I said before, you might just make really nice Welsh cakes. But this might just make you feel at peace with that because you don't feel like you're missing out because you're not striving to make the greatest Welsh cake in history, that kind of thing. And I just think that I think it's really important. It's a really good book. And I think that people should definitely, if there was one takeaway, from the book for like anybody listening, just the one, because I mean, the thing is there are like hundreds of takeaways. I mean, you know, you've got your four sections: fundamentals of voice, clear the obstacles, build the core, intensify the vision. You've got those, and you, as you say, people should work through the book and then come back and start the book again. But what's one thing that will really set people on the right track?
You have something to say that other people cannot say because they are not you, and you're passing through this world once, and you've got this shot to find out who you are and what you can contribute to that world.
I love that. I completely agree with that. I think somebody on this planet is the world's best lollipop lady, and they just someone's got to be, they wouldn't be there for a reason. I love that. Right, good. I'm going to pivot onto maybe more difficult questions. I couldn't really say, but we'll give it a whirl. We'll see how it goes. Do you have a favorite band / album?
Oh, see, I like some bands, like, you know, I'm old, so I love Queen, for example. I listen to Queen all the time.
That makes me sound old, because I like them. The age of it.
But, you know, I listen mostly to singer-songwriters who are, you know, it's coming, like, all from them, you know, which kind of makes sense to me, the art from the core. And my favorite album is, and this was all, this question's really hard to answer, but I would say an album called Mortal City from a singer named Dar Williams.
Okay.
She's a feminist, but she's very funny, and, you know, some of her work's really lighthearted, but really deep work as well.
Could you say what genre it is?
It's singer-songwriter. It's a person with a guitar, basically.
Right. Nice.
You know, and that's primarily who I listen to, I think, those kinds of, but I listen to a lot of stuff.
Do you listen while you work?
Often, but I have to listen to music that I already know. And I can listen to nonfiction, but I can't listen to fiction for some reason.
No,
my brain doesn't. But, you know, it's like what divides your brain and what does not cause any ripples in it, you know?
Yeah, I can imagine it would be quite annoying trying to do some emails listening to Dar Williams, because every now and again you'd just be looking out the window thinking about what she's
singing.
It's
beautiful. It's beautiful. And, you know, and I'm a lyrics person too, so...
Very good. Do you have art from your core, notwithstanding, do you have a favorite book?
I'm an incessant reader. I often have three books going at the same time. I'm trying to think.
We can pivot and say, what was the last good book you read, if that's any easier?
The last good book I read, I'll never remember the name, but it's called An Education, and it's a memoir of someone who came from a dysfunctional poor family and kind of, you know, struggled and made something of herself, but keeps getting kind of sucked back into the dysfunctionality. You know, I've read To Kill a Mockingbird more than one time. I've read a really sappy book that I'm embarrassed to say, but I would be lying if I didn't. A Bridge Across Forever by Richard Bach. Mm-hmm. And that's a love story. And it's a very kind of, you know, almost spiritual
like
love
Jonathan
story.
Livingston Seagull, isn't it?
It's yes, exactly. That's the same guy. Yeah. But he's also a pilot. And I love being in the air. So he often describes, you know, flying. So that's another one that I read.
Is the education one? Is that by Lynn Barber? Is it that one?
It might be. It might be. I'm so bad with names, especially since the pandemic. I don't know why.
That's fine. I'm Googling it. But okay. I mean, I read To Kill a Mockingbird last year. And I think I'd never read it before. And it was like the best book I read last year. I absolutely loved it.
It's amazing. And did you see the movie? Because it's beautiful.
No, you see, I haven't.
Have you seen the film?
No. I mean, I might watch it now, but sometimes with books like that, I prefer... It's like with Harry Potter. Harry Potter's kind of been ruined because you can't run Daniel Radcliffe it, can you? But
right. But I loved you it. Know, I often show just the opening credits of To Kill a Mockingbird to my students because just watch the credits. Mm. It's so beautifully done. But yes, it's a thing with me. I've named all my pets after characters in To Kill a Mockingbird. And, you know,
I think our
family watched
it. I think the thing I liked as well is it just made me chuckle every now and again. And I think you need mm-hmm. that in amongst everything else.
Oh,
it was
yes.
just quite chuckalicious. And yeah,
right.
It was a real winner. This is an aside. Me and my wife have started watching Poker Face, which is...
I don't know that.
It's a Natasha Lyonne TV show where she's someone who can kind of tell where people are lying. But one of the things I like the most about it is they have the credits at the start. And it's a bit like 1970s font and stuff like that, but it's almost like they list all the names of the people just as the opening scene kind of plays out. And it's just like it's weirdly retro, but I very much...
I love her. I should probably check that out.
It's pretty funny. Like, we're only 1.5 episodes in, but and also it's written and directed by the guy who did the Glass Onion films. Is it Glass Onion? No. What is it? The Knife?
I don't know.
This is a great bit of conversation here where all the facts go out the window, isn't it? The Knives Out. Rian Johnson, Knives Out. They're two good films with like Daniel Craig.
Oh, Knives Out, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So he wrote that and then this is his TV show. So it's of a good caliber.
Oh, okay, cool.
We managed to recover that situation. do you have a favorite film? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, Wings of Desire by Wim Wenders is my favorite film. Hands down. I mean, I watch a lot of movies, but that it takes you in. You're just in a different space through the whole film. And it's, I don't know, I find it transformative. Some people fall asleep when they try to watch it. You shouldn't watch it when you're tired.
Right.
Because it's dreamy. You know, it's just... It transports you, but it's just so gorgeous, and the message is wonderful. And
have you seen any of that? Because this year seemed to be a pretty good film year from an Oscar standpoint. There were some pretty powerhouse films, not many of which I've seen yet. But it feels like you might have seen some of like your zones of interest or your past.
I've seen Zone of Interest, which was just... I feel like a masterpiece. You know, it was just the subtlety and the examination of, you know, character and personality. It's mind blowing. Mm. I love Poor Things.
Right.
That is, you know, to my mind, that you know, was... I'm going to go back and watch that 5 or 6 times. I like films that really make me think. And I've watched Oppenheimer right before the Oscars. So I haven't even fully processed that. It's definitely an important film. And then I don't know which others I've seen. I've seen American Fiction. I enjoyed that.
I enjoyed American Fiction. I watched it the other day, but I'd read Erasure by Percival Everett. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that was, it took a bit of going through, but I really enjoyed, like, I've read a couple of his books and I really enjoyed that. So I thought American Fiction was good, but I think the book was better. And but to be honest, Barbie's the only other one I've seen at this point. Okay. But I've got them, but all of them are on my list. It's just, the thing is, on a Friday, on a Saturday night, you're like, so, shall we watch a film about some people who live next to Auschwitz? That's a no, is it? Okay, let's not watch
it.
It's not, it's not the easiest sell in the first place.
It's not. It's not.
You've got to be in the right headspace for it. Very good. Okay, exactly. One more question. Can you tell me an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Kate Kritz?
Okay, well, a lot of people know this after the book comes out, but right now, hardly anybody knows that I'm a collector of in-air experiences. I love being up in the air. So I've been up in gliders. I've been up in helicopters. One of my ex-boyfriends actually finagled a way for me to go up in the blimp, which I was so thrilled with because it's open. You know, you're in a cage, but there's no glass. So you're really out in the air. I've done some skydiving. I've learned to pilot a plane. And so that is my, you know, secret passion. And the one thing that I'm really looking forward to is the hot air balloon ride, because I haven't done that yet. I almost did it and we were rained out or whatever, but that's kind of the next on my list.
I love that. A collective in-air experiences. I wasn't sure where you were going with that.
I whenever I'm on an airplane, I'm like, you know, just commercial flying, I'm like the only one who's acting like an 8-year-old, like looking out the window and like, I'm trying to gauge how fast we're going and when are we going to get the lift? And, you know, it's, I still love it. You know, I'm still fascinated by it no matter how many times I fly.
I'd love to, I've not been up in a helicopter, but I'd love to have a go. Cause I feel like to me, that one feels like the coolest one. It's like the nimblest.
It is.
One.
Cause you do this, right? You go back and forth like this while you're flying and you even do some of this. Sorry, the audience can't see that.
But it's very
back and
grievous.
Forth, and you're sort of swinging back and forth and side to side as you're moving forward. So it's really a woo.
I've got a vague suggestion for you, which might work or might not. There's a YouTube channel called Circle with an E, and what they do is they get DJs who play music sets in interesting locations. And there's one, like, and they do them in some really lovely places. There's one of a pianist who's doing a live piano performance in what appears to be a lake in Iceland underneath the Northern Lights. There's loads of these sorts of things.
Oh, wow.
But they have a guy called Ben Bohmer, Bohmer, and he does kind of, I don't know what it is, like melodic house music or something like that. But basically, he's DJing in a hot air balloon over Turkey. And it's just this combination of like lovely music and lovely visuals. So you should definitely check that out because it's really, it's just a really nice combo.
Right.
Because there's something about hot air balloons. You just kind of want to look at them, don't you? Just kind of.
Yeah.
It's very good. Yeah. So that might be a nice one. I like that. Anytime I see someone doing something on the Vomit Comet now, I will think of Kate Kritz. It's probably next on your list. Hey, Kate, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Well, it's been a marvelous experience. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange. That's NEEDL.exchange with any thoughts, comments, or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.